This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we continue responding to your questions and comments on Islam. Lena Safi of the Felicity Foundation, based at the University of Michigan, discusses what the Quran says about women. But first, in 2009, the Kalamazoo Public Library launched One Place to support the nonprofit sector in Kalamazoo. Earlier this month, One Place director Tom Andrews announced his decision to step down from that position. We're going to spend some time discussing nonprofits in Kalamazoo with Tom Andrews. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure, Gordon.
So tell us, first of all, how did One Place get started? What was the idea behind it?
Sure. The idea of having what was called at that time management support organizations was not new. It's actually been around in Michigan for quite some time. And there was an interest in having something like that here to support the nonprofit sector and staff, board, and volunteers. And so a consortium of folks got together in 2008, led by the Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Community Foundation, the library, as well as some other nonprofit leaders, to examine models that were used, because every one of these is set up a bit different. They're funded a bit different. They kind of do some of the same work, but they're organized differently. And they looked in Michigan and surrounding states, and they found one that was located in a library, and that seemed to be a good idea because the library being an objective place is not something that's going to be like inside a foundation or anything like that. It's somewhat more of a safe and objective space. And they also, when you go to the library, programs are free. And so they wanted to make this accessible to all, at least remove the financial burden. And so they wanted to make sure that the programming here would be free of charge to everyone. And so they put together the model for One Place to be located in the library. So the staff are employees of the library. The library provides a lot of in-kind support. That is, they provide the workspace, the computers, the back office work of HR and financial reporting and things like that. And then the staff write grants to Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Community Foundation, and two, three other funders a year to provide the funding for this. So it's actually an ongoing collaboration of the Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Kalamazoo Community Foundation, the library, with support from Dorothy Dalton and Harold and Grace Upjohn Foundations.
So is part of the idea to help nonprofit organizations, which are sort of in their infancy, that want to get off the ground and give them the ideas about how you can get started, what are the steps you have to go through to actually begin being a nonprofit organization?
That is one important aspect. And in fact, we're kind of somewhat of a gatekeeper in a good way, as a way to say you're interested in starting a nonprofit or you've kind of got some ball rolling here and you want to see, is this possible? And so we're there to basically probably talk you out of it because there's a lot of nonprofits out there already. And probably what this person's wanting to do already exists in at least two or three different forms. But every once in a while, that's not the case. And so we can be there to help guide them through that process and let them know what's involved with it. And then they take the reins from there. But it's not just that. And it's not just the small nonprofits or, you know, fledgling nonprofits. Certainly that's a group we address. But we're there for all sizes. We've had folks from Bronson come over. We've had folks from some of the, from Western Michigan University. We've had folks from some of the larger retirement centers and things like that, as well as medium size, small size. We're there for all, not just the staff, but also board members and volunteers.
And when you're talking about an established nonprofit, then it's a case of, can we help them perform better? Is that what you're getting at? Can we do this work in a better way?
Yes. It's kind of, I guess, generically, that's what these centers do now called capacity building centers, but is really to build their effectiveness and efficiency and their skills and supervision, fundraising, marketing, things like that. And we address that. At One Place, though, we've really kind of, over the last 5 years, focused in to become a focused leader development organization. Because what we recognize is that a strong nonprofit sector is critical to the success of any community. I mean, you know, you go into a room, almost everybody in the room, in some way or another, is impacted by a nonprofit. They're on staff, they volunteer, they're on a board, they sponsor, they donate, they're a patron or a client. Regardless of the socioeconomic status of the person, they're probably impacted by that. And also, the nonprofit sector provides the human infrastructure that supports thriving communities. You need to look no further than healthcare or education and the groups that support that to see that that's true. So when you really focus on developing leaders, and so our participation in that cause, is to encourage and equip leader development. And so we see that, so we're not, as a way of recognizing that we have people who kind of take ownership of their role and really, you know, seek out the resources they need to get their jobs done at not just the executive level, but all the way through organizations, even in volunteer ranks as well, that are important volunteer positions. And so we want to, again, encourage and equip, meet them when they're ready to learn, meet them where they are, help them move those next steps. And what we find is that by doing that, the risk, of course, is, well, you develop these leaders and they'll leave the organization, right? Well, that may be true because some organizations don't have like a career ladder built in. They're just not that big. But what we find is people want to stay in Kalamazoo. So they may move to another organization. They may come back to an organization. We've seen that happen too. And so by focusing on individual leader development, over time, we'll strengthen the entire sector and actually connect them together so that they're working together more than just in their isolated organizations.
How different is being a leader in a nonprofit organization as opposed to being a leader in a for-profit business or maybe a leader in a government agency?
Yeah. On the one hand, I want to say there's not much difference at all. On the other hand, nonprofit leadership is harder. Generally speaking, you know, if you're running a for-profit business, you're in charge. You're the boss. It's your business. If you want to do something, you just do it. And generally, that's the way that works. And so, but you're running a small business. In a nonprofit, you're also running a small business, but you're also, while you may be the executive director or president, you're also accountable to a board of directors who is there as the representatives of the community because you are using community dollars in terms of donations and grants, et cetera, and maybe perhaps government funding as well. And then you also have constituents that you're accountable to. And so there's not just one bottom line. Sometimes you need to do the right thing, even though it may not be the most fiscally sound thing in the short run. So in many, and the reporting is, there's a lot more scrutiny on nonprofits than there are on for-profits, again, because of the use of tax-deductible donations and grants and federal dollars in that way. So in many respects, it's a more difficult type of role to do, a lot more juggling.
So the Attorney General put out this report not so long ago that spelled out organizations which, in this report's view, were not good places to donate money. And some problems have been pointed out with the methodology used here. But as someone who sees these nonprofits up close and their leaders up close, you know, if you're talking to someone who says, you know, I've got some extra money and I'd like to contribute to a certain cause or some things I care about, or maybe my time if someone wants to volunteer. What are the right metrics to look at to say, hey, you know, this organization is doing it right. It's a worthy investment of your money or your time.
Yeah, well, first of all, the Attorney General's report, this is something he's been doing every year for the last few years. And it's a report that just looks at Michigan campaigns from national organizations that do campaigns everywhere. Just looks at Michigan. It just looks at generally just telemarketing, and it's based upon partial data, and even the one-page introduction admits that. But then the conclusions that are in the headlines that are done with it kind of point fingers and say these telemarketers are stealing your money. And the thing is that's, you know, if you want to find telemarketers in that report that are maybe charging too much, you can find them. It doesn't take that much analysis. I've looked at it. But to point some of them that they lifted out are groups that are highly rated groups. They're doing great fundraising. They're very effective with their money. There's a fundraising efficiency. And so, for example, 10 cents would be that they spend 10 cents for every dollar raised. That's pretty good. And things like that, 15 cents versus 65 or even over a dollar to raise a dollar. Well, you know, sometimes groups do that. There's California colleges that are looking for alumni. They'll spend a dollar and a half for every dollar they raise because they're identifying alumni and they're thinking, once I've identified that person, then I can contact them every year. So the lifetime value of that donor pays for itself.
A loss leader. You're putting that $1.50 for the dollar up front, but down the road, you're counting on a lot more dollars coming in without having to spend the $1.50.
Yeah, yeah. And so there are already groups doing this. Charity Navigator, the Better Business Bureau, and they mention this again in their one-page summary. So there's really not a need for that report, and especially one that's just kind of incomplete in its data and kind of, I would say, absolutely wrong in its conclusions. So every year it comes out, every year I write something about it, and then we go to next year. So what can people do?
Yeah, what are the good things, the best ways to maybe try to measure this in a more honest and complete way?
Sure. You know, no individual really needs to measure it. If they're looking at national organizations like the American Cancer Society or something like World Wildlife Fund, they can go to Charity Navigator and see. And it's a very, very clear report on how effective they are with their fundraising and how efficient that 10 cents on the dollar kind of number. If it's more locally that they're looking, simply contact the organization, go to their websites. Organizations know that before people give, even if they get a letter in the mail or something, they're going to likely go to the website and see what they're about and things like that. Talk to friends. Said, well, I'm interested in the Kalamazoo Helpers Aid or whatever you want to call it. What do you know about this organization? Visit them, talk to them, that kind of thing. And I'd also say, make it something that you're interested in. So, for example, if you're interested in the arts and the dancing or something like that, then you seek out and look at those organizations here and say, what are they about? And is that something that I like and want to support? If it's food relief and things like that, you can look at the organizations that are working on food security and see what they're about. It's very accessible. And generally folks start small and then see how they are treated.
So with you stepping down as director of One Place, what is the future for that program?
The future is bright. Now One Place is two people. We're a program within a department of the library. So the two staff members can focus on just delivering the programs, developing, refining, delivering the programs. And by design, we don't do additional fundraising outside the grant and the grant writing, and we only report to the KPL board. So it's a kind of a lean organization. So it's myself and my associate, who's now the acting director. And when he came on board, Matt Leckel, he came on board last September with the knowledge that I might soon be needing to be away, either for a short time or to actually leave.
And is due to your health.
Yes, it's due to my health. And in fact, 2 months after he started, I was away for about 8 weeks. And so, but we hired him knowing that, we trained him knowing that, and he's come in and was able to handle that and another small leave without missing a beat. And so as we've gone into this time, we have things in place. We kind of have a standard operating procedure of how the year flows. And of course, there's decisions to be made and plans to be done, but he's very capable and very ready to do that. And then of course, later in the fall, the library and One Place and probably some of the partners will decide how they want to do, what kind of searches they want to do and how they want to fill that. So by the end of the year, it'll be fully staffed and running. And during the transition, Matt's more than capable of keeping going. So I think it'll be seamless in that respect.
As I read over your blog post, it kept coming up again and again that you really have enjoyed this position.
Yeah.
So how tough is it to step away? I mean, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, your health has not really cooperated here. That's the big problem. But how tough is it to give up a job that you really do enjoy doing?
Yeah, it's my dream job. So, it was the right decision. It's a tough decision. But again, it was one that, as I've gone through this journey here, I knew was coming. It's just a matter of when's the time. And so, it's been tough. I mean, we're kind of in a place where I really wanted to see it through another couple of years, ideally. But, you know, I'm here and I'm a phone call away and, you know, I'm, of course, not going to be involved day to day, but...
But you're still someone who doesn't mind picking up the phone or answering an email once in a while to help out.
Yeah, well, yeah, as asked.
As asked,
you know, I'm
sure.
Not going to butt myself in on that because it's not my thing anymore. But yeah, I love the job, and I think there's ways that perhaps, you know, when times are good, that I can contribute not necessarily to one place, but to the ongoing, you know, build, strengthen the nonprofit effort in small or large ways, however that works. I just know I can't commit to anything that's really long-term because things change from time to time.
Tom Andrews, thank you very much for your time. Good luck and good health to you, sir.
Thank you, Gordon.
Tom Andrews was, until very recently, the director of One Place, the Kalamazoo Public Library's program to support nonprofit organizations. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Back in April, we asked for your questions about Islam and for Muslims to tell us what people should know about their religion. We've answered questions about halal food, how to become an imam, and different interpretations of Muslim theology. We're going to deal with a more specific question on that last topic, women in Islam. And for that, we turn to Lena Safi. She is one of the chaplains at the Felicity Foundation on the University of Michigan campus. She joins us via Google Hangouts. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
Let's give a little background first. What is the Felicity Foundation?
The Felicity Foundation is a community organization that aims to provide an array of services on the University of Michigan campus, as well as campuses in southeastern Michigan. We provide student services, spiritual services, and we really try to make sure that there's a healthy and vibrant Muslim community life at our universities, as well as really just provide the support of what it means to be a Muslim and as best as we can educate both Muslims and our interfaith partners on our religion and on our lives.
And so what are some of the things that you might do in the average day, week, month?
Well, so there's always a lot of events to put on. So, you know, there are yearly things like Ramadan. So we try to have iftars or dinners where we break the fast together. And next week we have Eid coming up, which is the celebration after the pilgrimage. So those are kind of the big things that we do throughout the year. On a day-to-day basis, we might see students that need, you know, office hours, spiritual care. We might do an interfaith presentation at a school or on the university's campus. We might meet with some of the student groups on campus to help advise them on, you know, what the best way to approach certain issues are or, you know, curriculum advice, things like that.
Now, you have a degree in Islamic law and theology from Zaytuna College. Can you tell us a little bit about Zaytuna College, how it came to be and how you discovered it as a student?
Sure. So Zaytuna College is the first accredited Muslim liberal arts college in the U.S., I discovered it sort of by chance, actually. I was applying for schools, you know, back in 2010 for undergrad, and my brother said, hey, did you know that Sheikh Hamza Yusuf and Imam Zayd are starting a college? And I knew them because they're pretty popular Muslim clerics in the country, and I had seen them at different events. So I really trusted them and believed that whatever that they would kind of come up with themselves would be a wonderful program to attend. So I just applied, and, you know, I'm from Michigan, so moving all the way to California was kind of a big decision that I sort of made all of a sudden, and I was very happy to have been there and to really experienced the birth of the college, and it's really first and very formative 4 years.
So let's move on now to what we heard from our audience, and I'm going to read this in parts and have you maybe tackle it just a little bit at a time. There is a huge misconception about Islam that women are not given any autonomy and rights, while actually Islam gives the same or in some cases more rights to women than men. Would you say that that is true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting comment. I believe that one of, you know, part of Islam's really worldview is that the woman has to be held in high esteem. And there are a lot of things in the Quran and in the Prophet's life, peace be upon him, the Prophet Muhammad, which are very, very clear about that. So from things like heaven lies under the feet of your mother to, you know, only a noble man will treat a woman well, and only a sort of miserly or arrogant man will treat a woman poorly, really kind of points to what our religion sort of says about that sort of dynamic. Important to kind of mention that, you know, religions are perhaps aiming to an ideal, right? To kind of raise people up and to transform us into the best possible versions of us. And we very oftentimes fall short of those things. But when we really look at what, you know, woman's story in Islam, in the Quran, it really, it starts from the very beginning with Adam and Eve, and it goes all the way down to current day. And I think it's important to kind of recognize that there are many women mentioned in the Quran, from Mary, the mother of Jesus, who has her own chapter, to Moses' mother, to Moses' sister. And so it's really, we're very much, you know, a foundational part of the religion. And at different times, you know, we'll see different biases against women, different sorts of misogyny, and how the prophets of those times tried to battle with that and try to kind of shatter some of those misconceptions.
And the question goes on to say that, for instance, it is believed that women can't drive or be educated according to Islam.
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to modern, you know, politics, there might be things that, you know, perhaps are cultural and not so much religious. And I think that people will be very quick to say that. And I'm sure there are many things written to that effect. And I think that's part of, you know, sort of the academy is being able to write a paper to say, hey, look, that's not really a part of Islam, or even to have a Muslim cleric say that's not a part of Islam and have that kind of conversation go back and forth. And I think that is also one of the sort of privileges we have as Americans, is that we can have these sorts of conversations here. And sometimes we might be kind of projecting onto other places our own sort of beliefs or our own styles of understanding or whatever it is. So I do think that the most perhaps effective way to understand women in Islam and women's rights in Islam are really to kind of look at both, you know, the historical aspect, but also, you know, what does that mean for me, Lina, as a Muslim American woman in 2017, as opposed to kind of focusing so much on, you know, Muslim majority countries where I don't currently live and don't really have any power to change things as I might like to.
And then the question goes on to say that while the Prophet Muhammad's wife used to lead armies in battle and rode around the city on her camel. So I think we're kind of getting to that point that you were making about history, that this is something that's in the very early origins of what people wrote about Islam. And what does the history tell us beyond that?
Right. So the Prophet Muhammad, and Muslims will often say peace be upon him after mentioning his name, was born in 570 of the Common Era. And I think one of his really tremendous contributions to history was he informed us that, you know, judgment, that God's judgment of a human being, it transcends the physicality, right? So at that time, there was a lot. It was a very chaotic time. You know, there was infanticide, so people were burying their daughters when they were first being born because they were the wrong, you know, gender, or, you know, there was no real laws to protect, you know, the poor or women. Or so it was really a very tribal society, and that was a very difficult time to be alive. And so when the Prophet came with his message, he really was very revolutionary in a lot of ways. And so he says things like, you know, God's judgment is really based on your good character, right? So it's not on any of those physical things. And then the Quran actually goes on to go, you know, the next step and say those things are actually a blessing and you should embrace them and get to know one another, that God created these different tribes and peoples and races so that you may get to know one another. So they're really a positive thing if we're able to view it in the way that it's really supposed to be viewed, as sort of a means to get to know God and to really celebrate God in our various contexts and according to our cultures.
When we talked with Muhammad Khalil, who's the director of the Islamic Studies program at Michigan State, he told us that there's a wide range of opinion among Muslim scholars. Could you also find a wide range of opinion among scholars about what the Quran and Muslim teachings mean for women?
That's a good question. I would definitely agree that in general, in the canon, in the tradition, there's always going to be, very often there's going to be a difference of opinion. That's actually a joke that one of my teachers used to say. If somebody asks you a question about the religion and you don't know, just say there's a difference of opinion and that will get you out of the question. So that is something that's very common. However, there are certain principles that cannot be curtailed or, you know, transgressed upon, right? So human life, that's something very basic and there's no difference of opinion on that. Respecting family and really making sure that we tie, you know, we keep our kinship relationships really kind of positive. And that's something that the Prophet spoke about very often. And God actually relates, you know, our relationship with the divine to our relationship with our family members and our mothers and the women in our lives. So those are really principles that are very important. And really one thing I would really love to drive home is that the Quran always has to be taken along with the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that those two things cannot be separated. And the life of the Prophet is kind of like a commentary on the Quran. And so we see in his life that there are a lot of really, really wonderful and amazing women, some of whom were scholars, like his wife Aisha, who's one of the top four narrators of his sayings, which is, the hadith, which is a very important part of our canon. And actually one-fourth of the religious rulings come from her own speech. And the Prophet says about her, you know, to his companions, take one half of your religion from this woman, right? So really that's very, you know, foundational. And there are other examples of women who, you know, were businesswomen. They were giving him advice. They were also on the battlefield. They were really, you know, kind of doing a lot of different things. And I think that breaks a lot of the stereotypes that a Muslim woman has to be at home and her only duty is to, you know, bear children or something like that. A lot of these women didn't have children. And I think the Prophet, what he really says about that is, look, in whatever situation you find yourself in, there is a way to do it right, and there is a way to please God in that situation, and so that really allows for a variety of lifestyles.
Can someone be selective in reading the Quran or any other teachings and try to find something which they can then turn around and say, "Oh, well, this points to my belief that women are treated poorly," in much the same way that someone can take the Bible and can find the passage that convinces them that they are right. You can find arguments on both sides of many questions in the Bible. Can you do a similar sort of search in the Quran and arrive at the conclusion you want to reach?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that that's, like you're saying, sort of a universal aspect of, you know, anybody can be selective and try their best to drive something home. And it might be wrong. And it might be not even what the majority of the practitioners of that faith believe. And that's one of kind of the parts where we really need integrity, right? Everybody that, you know, engages religion is not going to be somebody who has a good intention, right? Or who really wants to do right by that religion or by that scripture or by whatever it is. But to really kind of be holistic and comprehensive, I think, is what's being asked. And to be honest, to look at it, the whole spectrum of the canon, and it's very extensive. And I think that's another thing about, you know, scholarship within any religion is, you know, in today's day and world, you know, perhaps somebody might get a 4-year degree and other people might view them as, you know, a scholar in that. But we all know that, you know, it's going to take more than the first 4 years to really kind of get a good handle on something. And that's something that was very important in our religion, was that people would study it for 20 or 30 years before they were given a public post to preach it, because it also included their own transformation as individuals. And so it wasn't just book knowledge, but it was their own spiritual transformation and really proving that they were able to imbibe the religious teachings and that the community saw them as a good and decent human being that would do right by the divine.
Lena Safi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Lena Safi is one of the chaplains at the Felicity Foundation on the University of Michigan campus. She joined us via Google Hangouts. Previous stories and interviews in our effort to respond to your questions and comments about Islam can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.